Trump was arguing against actual election results, state by state, city by city, and in his attempts to overturn that election, those election results. But here, there have been no published results of the election precinct by precinct. So it's not quite the same thing, is it?
It's not quite the same, but it is very similar. I mean, it's not just Trump, of course. It's also Bolsonaro. There are ties between Edmundo González, María Corina Machado, and the far right throughout the hemisphere. And yeah, you're right. We haven't seen the precinct by precinct results yet. The CNE has issued two bulletins showing the generalized results. By law, though, they have 30 days to present those results. We're not anywhere close to those 30 days being up, or about 2 weeks away. And already the CNE has turned over all of its data, including evidence of a massive cyber attack that occurred in Venezuela on July 28th, Election Day, and has continued since then, a cyber attack which we have evidence for from firms even in the United States, which have recognized a tenfold increase in denial of service attacks against Venezuelan websites, including the PSUV party.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank our two Venezuelan guests, Leonardo Flores, political analyst, activist, founding member of Venezuela Solidarity Network, and NYU Associate Professor Alejandro Velasco. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. The August Finance Committee meeting will be held on Thursday, August 22nd at 5:30 p.m. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, opponents of the I-5 expansion file a federal lawsuit to block new lanes in the Rose Quarter. Federal officials delay a decision on whether to keep endangered protections for grizzlies. And an Oregon man takes a plasma donation company to court for discrimination. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 13, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. Six local advocacy groups are filing a federal lawsuit against the Oregon Department of Transportation's plan to expand Interstate 5 in the Rose Quarter neighborhood of Portland. The groups include No More Freeways, the Elliott Neighborhood Association, Neighbors for Clean Air, Families for Safe Streets, the Association of Rail and Transit Advocates, and Bike Loud. They say the state transportation agency broke its own rules by approving the plan to expand the highway, and it didn't do enough environmental analysis. They say the plan would create more traffic and emissions, breaking with the state's emissions reductions goals. The lawsuit also names the Federal Highway Administration and the U.S. Department of Transportation for their part. The Rose Quarter expansion project was approved by the state legislature in 2017, expected to cost $500 million. Since then, costs have grown to $1.9 billion. That's partly because the plan also includes a cap on the freeway to reconnect the Albina neighborhood. Portland's historically black neighborhood was cut in half intentionally during the creation of the interstate system. The caps on the freeway would allow the community to build on top of the highway, reconnecting the neighborhood. That part of the project has separate federal funding, and the groups filing the lawsuit say they don't have a problem with the caps. Their focus is only on the expansion of the freeway, which they say won't improve traffic in the area and will mean major environmental impacts for the neighborhood near the highway. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has delayed a decision on whether Yellowstone area grizzly bears will have continued federal protections under the Endangered Species Act. It's been a point of contention among wildlife managers and conservation groups. Kathleen Shannon has more.
A federal decision on the endangered status of grizzly bears has been delayed. Wildlife managers in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho have petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to remove grizzly bears from the federal endangered species list in certain areas, including the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. That would leave states in charge of their management. According to the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee, the region's population has met recovery criteria for more than two decades after the species gained federal protections in 1975. But Andrea Zaccardi with the Center for Biological Diversity says the population spread across isolated ecosystems can be detrimental to recovery.
Because Yellowstone bears are completely isolated from any other population, they have genetic diversity issues. The ideal is that we keep these bears protected until the populations are connected and there's actual genetic exchange.
A federal decision expected on July 31st was delayed until early 2025. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has said the delay is to ensure consistency in decisions across several petitions. Governor Mark Gordon called the missed deadline unacceptable. The Yellowstone area is spread across three states, so if grizzlies are delisted federally, they'd be subject to multiple state management plans and hunting regulations. Wildlife Division Chief of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, Rick King, says there's already a tri-state agreement and, with the National Park Service and other federal agencies, a conservation strategy prepared.
It provides the overarching guidance and commitments that all of the states and those agencies will make to ensure a healthy and robust grizzly bear population persists even once they're removed from the ESA list.
Yellowstone grizzlies were delisted briefly both in 2007 and 2017, but both decisions were overturned in court. I'm Kathleen Shannon reporting for Wyoming News Service.
An Oregon man is suing a chain of plasma donation centers for discriminating against him as a gay man. He's supported by the ACLU of Oregon. John Kavanaugh says he tried to donate plasma at the Grifols USA Plasma Donation Center in Eugene, but was turned away because of his sexual orientation. A questionnaire asked if he had ever had sexual contact with a man. Because of his answer, Grifols told him he was forever banned from donating plasma. The lawsuit says the policy against gay and bisexual men is a, quote, discriminatory blanket ban that violates Oregon's public accommodations laws. All the plasma donated through Grifols is screened for sexually transmitted infections. Kavanaugh had a clean bill of health and no history of STDs. His attorneys say the company's policy is discriminatory, unnecessary, and rooted in harmful stereotypes. One of the attorneys wrote, quote, Grifols is perpetuating outdated stereotypes and false stigmas that dehumanize the LGBTQ+ community. Grifols' policy are in direct contradiction to current FDA guidelines, which recommend an individualized health assessment regardless of sexual orientation. Upon passing the health screening, Mr. Kavanaugh should have been able to donate plasma with the same dignity, respect, and equal rights and freedoms that is afforded to all Oregonians regardless of sexual orientation, end quote. The lawsuit is seeking $960,000 in damages and a change to the policy. Trump posts about domestic enemies on X. Native advocates challenge Arizona laws affecting voter engagement. The Pentagon deploys a submarine amid Iran-Israel tensions. And a new study highlights a funding gap for female candidates. With more on these stories, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is the final battle. With you at my side, we will demolish the deep state, and we will liberate America from these villains once and for all.
With a year-long ban from the social media platform X lifted, former President Donald Trump posted a list of domestic enemies he wants to drive out, including globalists, communists, marchers, and fascists. The former president also attacked what he calls the sick political class that hates the country and what he calls the fake news media. Ex-owner Elon Musk held a high-profile live interview with Trump Monday. The nonprofit newsroom ProPublica has released dozens of clips former Trump aides made during work on the Hard Right Project 2025. Trump has denied knowledge of the roadmap for his second term, but one clip shows a foreign policy deputy, Bethany Kozma, downplaying global warming.
According to our intelligence community, the number one threat facing our country today is, drumroll, climate change. Not Russia, not China, not AI, climate change.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announced the U.S. is sending a nuclear-powered guided missile submarine and an aircraft carrier strike group to the eastern Mediterranean. The Pentagon says Iran may retaliate against Israel for targeted strikes, including one that killed a Hamas leader while he was in Tehran. Retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling says the fact that Austin made the announcement publicly shows the situation is very serious.
Secretary Austin actually saying that the USS Georgia is going to be in the area is extremely unusual, but it's sending that deterrent signal to a lot of people who might be considering what they're going to do next.
Israel has placed its military on high alert. Hopes for U.S.-backed ceasefire in Gaza seem stalled. Civil rights advocates say two new Arizona laws could effectively suppress the votes of Native Americans. One requires a street address to register, something often lacking on reservations. The other lets county officials purge the registrations of anyone they think is not a citizen. Patty Ferguson Bonnie with the Indian Legal Clinic at Arizona State University says those voters already have reason to be suspicious.
Trying to translate to tribal people why it's important to participate in voting can already be a challenge when you're dealing with legal infrastructure that has tried to deny your existence.
A new analysis by the Center for American Women in Politics shows men contribute much more to political campaigns, with men outspending women across 10 states. Researcher Kira Sanvon Matsu says the funding imbalance cuts into women's ability to run for office or participate in politics.
Men are much more likely than women to be providing the funds that are fueling state candidates. And so this means that women have fewer resources to get their voices heard.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Grassy Narrows First Nation in Ontario, Canada, is filing a lawsuit over mercury contamination in their community that has continued for decades. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Northern Ontario First Nation is appealing to an international human rights commission over mercury contamination that has continued for decades. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the Grassy Narrows First Nation has also said it would sue the governments of Canada and Ontario over the contamination.
The moves are aimed at getting those governments to do more to tackle the mercury contamination of the English Wabagoon River system in northern Ontario. Grassy Narrows First Nation recently told a virtual hearing of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that many of its members have lost hope and that many struggle with work or school. They say after decades of mercury poisoning, they want justice. Canada is one of 35 member states of the Organization of American States, which oversees the Human Rights Commission. Judy DeSilva of Grassy Narrows says many in her community, up to 90%, live with the debilitating symptoms of mercury poisoning.
Our way of life has been totally destroyed. Like, our people were like proud fishermen, you know, land users and hunters, and this poison came and took all that away.
A recent study by researchers at Ontario's Western University shows that wastewater from the Dryden paper mill is mixing with mercury dumped in the water decades ago to make methylmercurate, an even more toxic cocktail. In the 60s and 70s, the mill dumped 9 tons of mercury into the river. Grassy Narrows chief Rudy Turtle wants action now.
Especially with the new generation and the children that are growing up, the river should be cleaned up for them, and they should be compensated because they're still taking mercury into their system.
The mill's owner says it only recently bought the company and would review the study. But the First Nation is suing Ontario and the federal government, alleging that the governments allowed the river system to be contaminated and then failed to do something about it, and at the same time authorizing industrial activities that made the situation even worse. Chief Turtle says he believes something would have been done if it had happened to a different region and population. Turtle wants authorities to ban industrial land use in or near the territory. Meanwhile, construction is expected to begin soon on a mercury care home and take up to 3 years to complete. Work is already underway on a new healthcare facility, and Ottawa says it's committed to the construction of a new water treatment plant. But lawyers for the First Nation call those actions a Band-Aid solution. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A Native Youth Art Festival recently celebrated its 10th anniversary on the Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota. Kathleen Shannon has more.
The Red Can Graffiti Jam is an art showcase set on the Eagle Butte campus of the Cheyenne River Youth Project, a Lakota youth advocacy organization founded in 1988. This year's event featured hoop dancing, poetry reading, community meals, skateboard painting, and a rock band from Rapid City. 14 graffiti artists from across the world made 9 murals in the campus's art park and the greater community. Given the group's mission to provide opportunities for kids, its executive director, Julie Garrow, says the jam is about more than art.
You know, it's community development. It is youth development. I would also say it's like cultural reclamation. I think it's language revitalization because we're using Lakota language on our walls. I think it's also healing.
Garrow says the jam was designed as a one-time event a decade ago to improve decrepit buildings in town, but it was so well received, she says the organization keeps hosting it. She adds next year, the group has been invited to bring a version of the Red Can Jam to the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. This story was produced with original reporting from Kate Mothis for Arts Midwest. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, it's KBOO's LGBTQIA2S+ panel series. Tonight, queer musicians. Tonight's weather will be sunny with an overnight low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny, clear, and warm with a high of 80 degrees. Today in history, in 1960, the Central African Republic declares independence from France. The quote of the day is from influential English director Alfred Hitchcock, born this day in 1899. He said, quote, "I'm frightened of eggs. Worse than frightened, they revolt me. That white round thing without any holes. Have you ever seen anything more revolting than an egg yolk breaking and spilling its yellow liquid? Blood is jolly, red, but egg yolk is yellow, revolting. I've never tasted it," end quote. Bird flu outbreaks within dairy cattle have led to heightened concerns about the spread of the disease. There's new research suggesting that dairy workers are at greater risk for infection, renewing questions about the influence of factory farms in limiting the spread and preventing the next pandemic. Mike Moen has more in Wisconsin.
Public health officials continue to monitor the spread of bird flu, with it passing from chickens to cows and humans. A new study finds the virus can linger on milking equipment for up to an hour, putting farm workers at risk. The CDC describes the risk to humans as low, given the absence of human-to-human transmission, but the new study suggests that dairy workers are particularly vulnerable to infection. A handful of those working near cows have become infected with no positive cases yet in the Badger State. Crystal Heath with the advocacy group Our Honor finds that worrisome given the high level of dairy production here. She wants industrial operations around the U.S. to embrace testing.
Not allowing researchers and scientists to investigate this is really concerning for public health.
Without a public health emergency, the federal government is limited in mandating testing. The Center for Biological Diversity says there isn't much motivation for farm operators to voluntarily comply because of the potential impact on livelihoods. But advocates note that workers, not farm owners, are exposed to the virus without being able to speak up for themselves. Immigrants make up 51% of all dairy labor. And Heath says with the potential for infections going undetected, the situation should compel the U.S. to place less emphasis on industrial agriculture for its food production.
Modern animal agriculture creates the conditions that can lead to the next pandemic, with a lot of genetically similar stressed animals in close contact with human workers.
The U.S. government is working on candidate vaccines for bird flu as part of the pandemic preparedness. The CDC says the development of a vaccine is a multi-step process and can take months to complete. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. This story is based on original reporting by Julieta Cardenas at Sentient.
A new report finds that high-paying economic opportunities will heavily favor workers with bachelor's degrees and other forms of post-secondary training. Over time, more work, even in traditional blue-collar jobs, will require expertise in fields such as technology. Will Walkie reports.
Economic opportunities will favor workers with higher levels of education, according to a new report. Researchers found that 85% of good jobs will go to people with bachelor's degrees or other forms of post-secondary training by 2031. Report author Artem Gulish with the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce says even traditional blue-collar work, such as construction, will increasingly require apprenticeships or courses in fields like machinery and tech.
While those jobs are going to be growing, in part because of the infrastructure investments that the federal government and state governments have been making in recent years, those opportunities are going to be shifting to middle skills.
Gulish says a good job pays a minimum of $43,000 a year for workers between ages 25 and 44. He says over time it will be more challenging for those with only high school degrees to earn that salary. About 40% of Virginia residents have a bachelor's degree or higher, which ranks it in the top 10 states in the country. In general, college enrollment of young people is actually declining, especially among men. Gulish says the future labor market is not set in stone, especially as technologies such as artificial intelligence keep evolving. But having a post-secondary degree will often make you more employable.
The future does not look like the present, so having that ability to adapt and learn and upskill and reskill and pick up new skills will definitely be beneficial.
Georgetown's report found that there will be more good jobs on the market by 2031 compared to now. That's partly because policymakers are facing pressure to deliver higher job quality rather than just lower unemployment. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. I'm Will Walkie, Virginia News Connection.
Heat is a serious threat to people's health and is made more dangerous in states like Washington and Oregon, where many people lack air conditioning. Some tips can help people stay cool, especially if they don't have AC. Washington State has already seen record-breaking heat this summer. Dr. Scott Itano is a family medicine physician in Washington for Kaiser Permanente. When temperatures are high, Itano suggests people avoid going outside during the peak hours of 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. He also says to use cool water to cool down and drink more water than usual.
If you don't have air conditioning, consider trying to go to public facilities that have air conditioning, things like public libraries or shopping centers or things along those lines. Even just a couple hours in air conditioning can really help you survive the day when we have these intense heat waves.
Northwest homes have historically had the fewest air conditioners of any in the country. However, heat waves in recent years have changed that. In Seattle, for instance, more than half of homes in 2021 had air conditioning, up from 31% in 2013. Itano says there's a spectrum of heat-related illnesses, starting with heat exhaustion, which includes tiredness, fatigue, or lightheadedness. He says a more serious condition is heat stroke.
That's when you get symptoms that might mimic a stroke. So you might pass out. You might have a seizure. You might have altered mental status. So those are definitely more serious symptoms. And if you're experiencing them, you'd want to call 911 right away or seek care.
Itano says certain groups of people are more susceptible to heat-related illnesses, including the elderly and younger people. He notes people with chronic medical conditions should also be careful.
You have diabetes or asthma or lung disease or heart disease. Heat intensifies and stresses the body. So any stressor to the body is going to make those conditions worse and potentially put you at more risk.
That was Dr. Scott Itano, a family doctor in Washington. Kids are heading back to school, and parents can do a few things to make the transition easy on them. As Eric Tegedoff reports, scheduling checkups at the doctor and reestablishing routines are important.
As kids head back to school, doctors say there are a few ways parents can prepare for the transition. One important item on the checklist is getting a checkup at the doctor. Well, child visits allow the opportunity for physicals, if kids are playing sports during the year, for instance, and mental health check-ins as well. Dr. Ryan Brown is a pediatrician at OU Health University of Oklahoma Medical Center. He says doctor visits can help with things parents might forget, too.
You don't want to have a kid that's supposed to be on medication at school, and then school starts, and like, oh, I forgot to get it, and now he's going 1 or 2 or 3 weeks during the school year without the medication that he needs to do well at school.
Brown says scheduling dental appointments and eye exams are also important. Dr. Rhonda Randall with United Healthcare says reestablishing routines for kids is critical as well, noting that sticking to schedules in the morning and at night is stabilizing.
Do you have family dinners on a regular basis? I recognize that you can't do that every night. Everyone's busy and sometimes running in different directions, but doing that as often as possible, it really does create a routine that's predictable and healthy for the child.
Brown says parents should be open and listen to their kids. He says those first few weeks can be awkward and stressful.
Letting the kids know it's okay to be scared. It's okay to feel like you're not accepted that first week or two. Like, oh, I don't know, they don't like me or whatever. Everybody has those emotions. And give it more time.
For Oklahoma News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Project 2025 has implications beyond the borders of the United States. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. In part two of his analysis, Gertov looks at how U.S. trade and nuclear policy would be impacted, as well as policy on Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, and Mexico. He says every policy stance accords with Donald Trump's views, which are nationalist, interventionist, and partial to military-industrial expansion. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Last week, I explored the politics of Project 2025, the far right's plan for dismantling the so-called deep state and replacing it with a president-centered authoritarian system designed with Donald Trump in mind. In foreign affairs, I previously discussed China and Russia, two of the five countries the project identifies as priorities for the next administration. Iran, Venezuela, and North Korea are the others. Today, I'll discuss those countries and military affairs, but I begin with international trade, a key section of the Project 2025 document authored by none other than Peter Navarro, one of Trump's main advisors who recently served time in jail. Navarro's chapter is entirely in line with Trump the Tariff Man's ideas on trade policy. Navarro argues that a U.S. trade policy that matches China's, India's, or any other country's high tariffs is the best way to lower the U.S. trade deficit. High tariff walls will also force U.S. multinational corporations to build factories in the U.S. and will be good for American farmers. Mind you, nothing of the sort happened during Trump's tenure. Navarro also favors trade and financial decoupling from China, which he accuses of no less than 50 forms of economic aggression. Well known for his ideologically grounded view of China, Navarro writes that the Chinese, quote, never bargain in good faith. His proposals would virtually end most trade with China, U.S. investment in China, and Chinese investments in the U.S. Research and educational exchanges with China, which have been very beneficial to the U.S. economy, would also be greatly restricted. The costs to U.S. consumers and scientific and technological research institutions, the impact on global supply chains, the likely retaliation in the form of a halt to Chinese exports of rare earth and other vital minerals to the U.S., and raising of tariffs in response to higher U.S. tariffs, all these very likely outcomes are never considered by Navarro any more than they were by Donald Trump as president. On Iran, Project 2025 says, quote, the U.S. can utilize its own and others' economic and diplomatic tools to ease the path toward a free Iran and a renewed relationship with the Iranian people, unquote. How to do that? Another reversion to previous Trump policies. Harsher sanctions, support of Israel to, quote, take what it deems to be appropriate measures to defend itself against the Iranian regime, and ultimately seek regime change. The Middle East otherwise gets scant attention. On North Korea, quote, the U.S. cannot permit the Democratic People's Republic of Korea to remain a de facto nuclear power with the capacity to threaten the U.S. or its allies. The DPRK must not be permitted to profit from its blatant violations of international commitments or to threaten other nations with nuclear blackmail. Both interests can only be served, says the document, if the U.S. disallows the DPRK's rogue regime behavior, unquote. Leaving aside what disallows means, this proposal follows on Trump's failure to strike a deal with Kim Jong-un when Trump had the chance. Venezuela is the focus of Project 2025's Latin America section. It says, quote, the next administration must take important steps to put Venezuela's communist abusers on notice while making strides to help the Venezuelan people, unquote. That ambiguous advice has been overtaken by events. Venezuela's contested presidential election on July 28 has already led the U.S. to recognize President Nicolas Maduro's opponent, Edmundo Gonzalez, as the winner and maintain sanctions. Mexico is treated as a cartel state that has lost its sovereignty. Quote, the next administration, says the project, must both adopt a posture that calls for a fully sovereign Mexico and take all steps at its disposal to support that result in as rapid a fashion as possible, unquote. Is Mexico's lack of full sovereignty an argument for more direct U.S. intervention in Mexico? Trump is known to have once expressed the view, while president, that the U.S. should consider invading Mexico on the pretext of disrupting the drug trade. On nuclear weapons and military spending, Project 2025 proposes to increase production and modernization of nuclear weapons and resume nuclear weapons testing in violation of the comprehensive test ban. These ideas, fully in line with Trump's infatuation with nuclear weapons, are all tied to proposals for major increases in the U.S. military budget, strengthening the U.S. defense industrial base, and increasing U.S. arms sales abroad. As president, Trump would be free to accept or reject any part of Project 2025's ideas, but whatever he accepts will be no less dangerous than any of his own ideas. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.